Well, it's good for all of you to join me today. I appreciate it so very, very much. Appreciate your interest in studying this with me. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, beginning in verse 25 in just a moment. I sure hope everybody's staying healthy. Miss seeing all of you. Miss being together. But we all persevere and make it through this together. We're going to come to our third of our studies in chapter 7. This will be the final one in chapter 7, then we'll move on. And this is going to talk about the advice of staying single, or advice to singles, or the value of singleness versus being married. We begin in verse 25, and Paul said, "Concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, but yet I give commandment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has been made trustworthy." First of all, I think the word virgin has to do with just unmarried, not only to women. And the imprimatur of the stamp of this is, in whom the Lord has found trustworthy, or faithful, dependable. Paul has said this a few times. I have no commandment from the Lord. The Lord, not the Lord, he will say throughout the text. In verse 40, look there. According to my judgment, and I think I also have the Spirit of God. And what Paul is saying is, this is the best possible judgment I can give you. This is the judgment of an inspired man. If we think of this just as an opinion, it may connote the wrong thing. If we think of it, an opinion, as a belief not based on absolute certainty or positive knowledge based on what seems valid or probable to one mind. Closer is the definition, the formal judgment of an expert on a matter in which his advice is sought. I like that. Here is the judgment of an expert. He is an inspired man. Paul says this is the best you can get. To ask of Paul is the same as asking of God. Remember what it was said of Ahithophel? To ask of Ahithophel was to speak to God, or ask of God. So you ask judgment. Here's the best possible judgment, the best possible advice I can give you. If you don't want the advice, you don't sin. But there are going to be tribulations in the flesh. There's going to be consequences of you rejecting the advice. He's going to give four different reasons to the advantage of being single. First of all, verse 26, singleness would encounter less stress from a hostile world. Notice what he says. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress. It's good for a man to remain as he is. We've stressed this, we've emphasized this all through our studies thus far. About 10 years from this point in which Paul writes, the Roman Emperor Nero is going to falsely blame the Christians for setting fire to the imperial capital. And slaughter of Christians of all ages began to just be rampant, overflow the city. They were punished in some of the most unspeakable, unbearable ways. I don't think that's what Paul is talking about here. I think probably what Paul is talking about here, my supposition, my opinion is, and this is not the opinion of an expert, just a judgment, just an opinion, is closer to the destruction of Jerusalem as they're getting closer to that period of time. But then again, it could be something completely different that's taking place in Corinth. And Paul's advice is, stay single. Suffering alone is difficult enough, but watching a mate or a child suffer with you can be unbearable. It's one thing. This is not a parallel, just an illustration. It's one thing to lose a job or to have your reputation affected. But when that loss of job or reputation affects a mate or a child, it increases the hardship. If single and the threat of persecution and hardship should discourage you from having a mate, then he says, be unmarried. The second is found in verse 28. He said, but even if you do not marry, you have not sinned, and a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh, but I would not spare you. Second is, singles will experience fewer difficulties on a personal level. It's good for a man to be unmarried, but if married, you don't seek to be loosed. It gets back to when you violate judgment, you'll have problems. So he says in verse 27, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. The whole matter of marrying in spite of the present distress, or not marrying because of the present distress, has nothing to do with sinning or avoiding sin. It's no more a sin for virgins to marry than for any other person to marry, but expect tribulation and anxiety. I think that tells us that unmarried might look at singleness and see only the weeds. but a large number of divorces today are a telltale sign that marriage provides anything but an idyllic pasture of green grass. Yes, there are rewards, but there are tremendous responsibilities that come. I'd like to share this quote with you from a fellow by the name of Mike Mason. Marriage comes with a built-in abhorrence of self-centeredness. In the dream world of mankind, mankind's complacent separateness. Amidst all our pleasant little fantasies of omnipotence and blamelessness and self-sufficiency, marriage explodes like a bomb. It runs aggravating interference pattern and unrelenting guerrilla warfare against selfishness. It attacks people's vanity and lonely pride in a way that fewer things can, tirelessly exposing the necessity of giving and sharing, the absurdity of blame, angering, humiliating, melting, chastening, purifying. It touches us where we hurt the most, in the place of our lovelessness, dragging us into lifelong encounters which times may be full of boredom, tension, unpleasantness, or grief. Marriage challenges us to abandon everything for the sake of love. I think that's powerful. The third reason Paul will give is singles can expect fewer distractions from the time spent on spiritual matters. Look at verses 29 through 31. But this I say, brethren, time is short. So that from now on, even those who have wives should be as they, though they had none. Those who weep as though they did not weep. Those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice. Those who buy as those who did not possess. And so then he will say in verse 31, and those who use this world as not misusing it, for the form of this world is passing away. I don't think he's saying the time of this world is short. Then you have general counsel about remaining married to the end of the world. But all the things that have to do with this fashion of this world, all the things people are aspiring to are temporary. Great persecution is coming upon them. And so that great persecution is coming. Those that buy will be as those who buy not. All aspirations will pass, is what he's saying. Back of all the questions of marriage and non-marriage lies the attitude of the true Christian toward all the transient temporalities of the earthly life. Hold earthly ties and possessions loosely. Marriage, tears, joy, purchases, the whole world of earthly things. We may have them all as Christians, use them all, experience them all. How? For what they are, as belonging to this passing world. Why? It's all passing away. Temporary, slipping, moment by moment, we try to cling to them to make them more than they are. Then the fourth reason is found in verse 32 and verse 34. I want you to be without care, for he who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. Verse 33, but he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. And then he says, but she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. Verse 34. Verses 32 and 33 said there is carefulness. There's anxiety that comes. There's care in the sense of devoting special attention. Marriage requires attention. And so you're going to be anxious in the things of the world, your mate, and anxious in the things of the Lord. He's not saying that they don't love the Lord enough, but the unmarried man doesn't have but one consideration. Not distracted. Serving the Lord is the only responsibility he has. The unmarried man has a responsibility, and the Lord expects it from him. Not he who loves his wife. He who loves his wife is obligated to care for his wife. How he may please her. Many may think he's not concerned about pleasing the Lord. No. He's not just henpecked. He is concerned for the things of his wife. He has the concern for his wife. He has a concern for the things of the Lord. In verse 34, again, he will say, but she who is married cares about the things of this world, how she may please her husband. The wife is general for woman, for the married, widowed, or unmarried. And the difference is a divided mind. Here's the wife and the virgin are divided. Seems to apply to their attention and to their care. One cares for her husband, and as she may please him, the other cares only for the world. So, he says to the singles, rejoice. Thank God and enjoy being single the best you can at this time in your life. And then he says, rechannel your energies. Instead of using them to look for a marriage partner, to advance your career, use them to give yourself totally to God, fulfilling his desires as if he were your earthly beloved. And then he says, quit hungering for the grass on the other side of the fence. Stay in your lane, stay in your pasture. Yes, even though you're alone, and feed on many of the benefits God has for you there. The pasture of singleness can be a pasture of contentment if you'll rejoice, reverse, or rechannel your energies and relax. So then we come to verses 36 through 38. And this is a very challenging set of passages. I'll walk through this with you the best I can. Let's read first of all. If any man thinks he is behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she's past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He who does not sin, let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity but has power over his own will, and has determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then he who gives her in marriage does well, but he who does not give her in marriage does better. There's a suggestion here of the father is involved here. If a man, in verse 36, if a man thinks he's behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she's past the flower of her youth. I'm not sure he's talking about the father and his virgin daughter here. I'm not sure that's what the text is talking about. Obviously, the point here is being steadfast in heart as opposed to having your attentions divided. One translation reads it this way. If anyone considers is behaving indecently toward his virginity, if he's beyond his prime, and so it ought to be, let him do what he chooses. He does not sin. Let them marry. But he who stands firm in his heart, not having any need, but who has authority of his own will, and he's judged this thing in his heart to keep his own virginity, he does well. So basically, he's saying there what he's always said. If you can maintain your self-control, then don't get married. There's nothing indecent about it. If you can maintain your self-control, don't get married. There's no sin. Good News for Modern Man says this way. In the case of an engaged couple who have decided not to marry, if the man feels he's not acting properly toward the girl, if his passions are too strong and he feels that they ought to marry, then they should get married as he wants to. There's no sin in this. But if a man, without being forced to do so, has firmly made up his mind not to marry, if he has his will under complete control and has already decided in his own mind what to do, then he does well not to marry. Again, what Paul has said all through the chapter. If you can maintain your control and not burn in your lust, then stay single. If you cannot, then you have a mate with whom you can share that burden and have that need fulfilled. One says, thinking of the virgin girl he will marry, talk about the man who would marry. He chooses. If the girl's going to end up an old maid, he figures in some disservice to her, and he behaves in some appropriate way by leaving her to remain a virgin, need so require, let them marry, no problem. So here's a man who has a virgin, a girl he will marry, and he begins to look at it, he makes a choice, and he said, well, she's going to be past the flower of her time. It's going to be a disservice to her if I don't marry her, so you marry. But he's steadfast in heart, and convinced the best thing to do is remain unmarried. He has no necessity, power of his own will, decreed to keep her. He doeth well, he does a good thing. So, once again, it's kind of saying the same thing two different ways. Here's the man who would marry, and he looks at the girl and says, well, I'm going to do a disservice to her. So he marries, and he doesn't sin. But here's a man who looks at her, and he says, I'm steadfast in heart. I have power of my own will. I'm not going to marry. He doesn't sin. But someone said, it's a father. Here's a virgin, and you said it was her father. And you said to him, you arranged for marriage. And she wants to marry you. You want to marry her. She doesn't sin. If agreeable and doesn't marry, that's better. Past the flower of her youth, her peak, her bloom. Before she's reached this stage, the father has no misgivings. So there's four reasons for the father so acting. First, the father's firm resolution because of what Paul just said. Second, no necessity. Daughter has no special sexual urge to marry. Third, power over his own will. Entirely able to decide the matter according to his will. He's not arbitrary or stubborn. The first and third factors are closely related. Fourth is the decision in his heart to guard his mate. And so here is the decision of the father to protect his daughter. If she married good, if she doesn't marry good. And so I'm not sure whether the father's involved or whether the father's not. I rather think it's one of the previous three. I'm not sure the father's involved in this text. That doesn't seem to be anything that suggests supplemented here. Read again verse 36 through 38. If a man thinks he's been behaving improperly toward his virgin, someone said toward his virgin would imply the father toward his daughter. Again, I don't think that's a necessary implication. If she's past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. If he wants to marry, if he doesn't marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity or the power, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and he turned his heart that he'll keep his virgin, he does well. Not going to marry, not going to violate her, not going to do anything inappropriate to her. So that he who gives her in marriage does well. He does not give her in marriage, does better. It's okay if you do, okay if you don't. Romans and Greeks' choice of a wife rarely depended on affection. In many cases, the father chose for the son a wife, and rarely was the consent of the woman necessary. She was obliged to submit to the wishes of her father. And so under the patriarchal and Mosaical dispensation, the father's own power over the children in the matter of marriage was paramount and needed no consent. After the exile, only when one became of age was consent necessary. And so I think what he's saying here, verses 36 through 38, is what he's been saying all through the whole chapter. The repeated refrain. If you can maintain your control and not burn your lust, stay single in this present distress. If you can't, let each man have his own wife, each woman have her own husband, and fulfill your obligations one toward another there. And so if you can maintain your steadfastness of heart, fine. If you can't marry, you're not going to dishonor her this way. You're not going to dishonor her the other way. Then we come to verse 39 and verse 40. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she's at liberty to marry to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. But she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment. And I think I have the Spirit of God. When the husband's dead, the bond that bound the husband and wife together with God is over. She's free to whom she'll be married, only the Lord. The meaning often given to this is that if it's a widow who's a Christian and she remarries, she must marry a man who is a Christian. But the context is dealing with human relationships that's not peculiar to Christians, the marriage relationship. God doesn't have an absolute standard for marriage, that is, one set for non-Christians and one set for Christians. Any principle relating to marriage, divorce and remarriage, is applicable to all men. There's nothing in the context that indicates that what is said in this verse is not applicable to all men. This is a widow must marry a Christian. It means that if any widow, Christian or non-Christian, must marry a Christian man. The meaning, a key to proper understanding, is found in understanding the phrase, in the Lord. Does it modify whom or marry? That is, does Paul speak of an action or a person in the Lord? We have no trouble with Ephesians 6 and verse 4. In the Lord refers to an action. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. I'm not saying if parents aren't Christian, you don't have to obey them. But when we come to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we say it's a person. Paul is not speaking of a person in the Lord. That is a Christian, but an act marriage that's in the Lord. A marriage that has his approval, and that is in keeping with all he has said about marriage. The widow could not more marry a man divorced unlawfully than the virgin. She must honor the law of God. The widow is free, just as free as she once was. The only restriction is to honor and obey the law of God. When she was a virgin, she had to do that. If she must marry a Christian, and she violates the law, now what do you have? You have a widow who is a Christian, and she marries a non-Christian. What do you have? Say, well, she shouldn't have done that. But she did. What do we do now? Well, we can't do anything about it because she's married now. Well, there could be no plainer cause of sin. Now we have an attitude problem. A widow, though she doesn't have the right, but does anyway, sins in her heart, if nothing else. And the brother who believes she said she was wrong and doesn't do anything about it is bad as well. Now you just whitewash sin. But I don't think he's talking about the person. I think he's talking about the act of marriage. So he says, a wife is bound by law to her husband as long as he lives, but if her husband dies, she's at liberty to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. Talk about the person she's marrying, that she has a right to marry that person and he has a right to be remarried. And then verse 40 follows up the same thing he's been saying. This qualifies the whole thing. I'm not doubting anything I said. He's not doubting whether he's inspired or not. He's expressing with a soft concern of knowledge that grows out of his inspiration. Judgment was judgment dictated by inspiration. And what he says here, that she's happy if she remains as she is, according to my judgment, and I think I have the Spirit of God. Well, that brings us to a close of chapter 7. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being part of this study. And we'll pick up the study in chapter 8 another time. Thanks so much.